Welcome to In Jest, the podcast series designed for primary care and brought to you by the Primary Care Society for Gastroenterology. My name is Charlie Andrews, a GP with an extended role in gastroenterology based near Bath. In Jest is an educational podcast. It's designed to enhance your knowledge and learning in various aspects of gastroenterology. It is not designed to replace your clinical judgment, and it's important always to practice within both local and national guidelines. In this episode, I'm speaking to Melanie Orchard, a consultant general surgeon, about diverticulitis, a very common topic, something we see a lot in primary care. And we're aiming to demystify this topic for you and give some practical advice and guidance around how to approach the patient with suspected diverticulitis. So Mel, thanks so much for joining me today.
You're welcome.
I'm looking forward to getting into this topic and talking to you about diverticulitis. I thought maybe at the beginning we could start off by going into some of the terminology that's sometimes used around this topic. So I'm thinking about things like diverticulosis, diverticular disease, diverticulitis. Are they all the same? Are they slightly different things? Do you think you could talk to us a bit about what all of this means?
Sure. So diverticulosis is, to me, it's just the presence of a diverticular. It's those little pouches we know that develop in the colon at weak points. It's actually felt to be quite a complicated pathophysiology involving a combination of diet and genetics and colonic motility and microbiome, and we don't really understand it. But I think what we're becoming increasingly aware of is that you get this collagen deposition in the bowel wall, and it becomes sort of stiffer. The term diverticular disease I don't really use in my daily practice, but I suspect it just sort of refers to anybody who's getting any problems related to their diverticulosis. And then diverticulitis is what we see a lot as surgeons, and that is inflammation of a diverticular, and it's associated with complications. You can get abscesses, perforation, fistulas, strictures. But I think what we're becoming increasingly aware is that there is this sort of symptomatic diverticulosis where you get pain with this thick-walled bowel, and you can really feel it when you're scoping someone. It's really difficult to sort of navigate a thick-walled diverticular segment, and it's really uncomfortable for the patients. But I think that's what has never really been highlighted in our medical school teaching or our GP training or whatever, is this sort of symptomatic diverticulosis.
So we've got the diverticulosis, we've got the presence of those diverticulae, we've got symptomatic diverticulosis, and then we've got diverticulitis, and helpful just to have them in mind when we're going through this. What is the prevalence of diverticulosis? Do we know how common it is? And do we know what some of the risk factors for it are?
So it's really common. Diverticulosis is present in about a third of people over the age of 60, two-thirds over the age of 80. Interestingly, sort of over the career, my sort of career and training, it's become more common in young people. So it used to be a diagnosis we never really considered when someone in their 40s, 30s, even 20s came in with left lower quadrant pain. And now it very much is. So it's said to be present in about 5% of people at the age of 40. We know it's more prevalent and more likely to be complicated in people with lower socioeconomic groups. And it's probably associated with same sort of things we see for all our conditions. It's obesity, lack of exercise, smoking, and those are some of the things we can address as we start to manage people. We know that in the West, 90% of it is in the sigmoid colon. Interestingly, in the East, it's much more right-sided. In Japan, 70% is right-sided. So there's definitely sort of factors at play there related to our lifestyles and our diets in the West.
And does our diet have an impact? So, you know, is constipation a big risk factor, straining, those sorts of things, low fibre diet?
It's felt to be. I'm not sure there's a massive amount of evidence that increasing fibre actually improves things, but it's definitely what we tell people and how we manage it. There are certain medications we should think about. So people on steroids, obviously, higher risk of perforation, anyone on opiates. Aspirin and NSAIDs increase your risk of both diverticulitis and diverticular bleed, which we haven't mentioned so far. And NSAIDs, but not aspirin, increase your risk of perforation. So there's a few bits and pieces we can keep an eye out for medication-wise as well that increase your risk. But fibre is definitely something we talk about a lot.
And that actually brings me on to this question, which is that this is quite a common scenario in primary care. The patient's had a colonoscopy and then it says that they've got diverticula present. And then the patient comes to you and says, what should I do about this? What does it mean? Is there any advice that we can give them? What would you sort of say to that patient who, you know, may be completely asymptomatic from it, but has now been told that they've got this condition and they don't know what it means and they don't know what to do? Should they be avoiding things? You know, how do you approach that?
Okay, so I mean, firstly, that's probably a failing from us when we've scoped them, because we should be giving them information leaflets about diverticular disease. I think it's worth saying that only about 15% of people with diverticulosis get any complications from it, so they're most likely to be asymptomatic. It's definitely about modifying risk factors, so stopping smoking, losing weight, exercise. Those are thought to reduce the likelihood of getting diverticulitis and complications. From my point of view, if I end up operating on them, I'd be much more grateful if they were lower weight and non-smokers. Have a look at the medication, aspirin and NSAIDs. If you get a diverticular bleed, then reviewing your risk benefit for that anticoagulant, for someone who's on anticoagulants, might be helpful. And then just reassuring them that it's common and relatively unlikely to cause them trouble. Historically, we always said, oh, don't have seeds, nuts, popcorn, sweet corn, whatever. NICE guidelines say there's no evidence for that. As I said before, we're not sure there's any evidence for increasing fibre, but we do still advise it. The guidelines say increase it slowly so they don't suddenly get really bloaty and flatulent, because they won't thank you for that. But also alongside that, increase their fluid intake, avoid constipation. And patients who tend to constipation, the sort of bulk forming laxative, my go-to is fibre gel, can help them sort of keep their bowels regular and avoid straining. But generally just sort of reassure them it's there and it shouldn't cause them too much trouble.
It's all pretty sensible stuff, isn't it? And it's actually fairly healthy advice that we're giving to people. And it's good that the seeds and nuts and things, you don't have to remove them. Yep. So that'll please, you know, many of our patients. You mentioned about symptoms of diverticulosis, and you mentioned there a little bit about bleeding and things like that. So we're not talking quite yet about diverticulitis, but what sort of symptoms can people get with diverticulosis?
So that sort of symptomatic diverticulosis that I talked about before, that's usually pain. It's usually in the left lower quadrant, although it can be more sort of midline. And it's usually relieved by passing wind or opening your bowels. I usually find that quite a reassuring symptom that patients describe to me. All the other symptoms are sort of related to it being more complicated. So a diverticular bleed can be a one-off, can be fresh blood, can be altered blood. Often it's quite a big volume and can be quite scary for patients. So they will almost always seek medical advice if that happens.
How do they get the bleed? I'm going a little bit more technical here, but is this sort of a bleed from within one of the diverticulae? Is that how it works?
Because the diverticulae form where the vasa recta penetrate the colon wall, I've always assumed it's just irritation of one of them. The majority of the time it just settles by themselves, and if they're getting a bad bleed, we watch them in hospital and wait for it to settle. There are good guidelines for if your hemoglobin's all right, your age is okay, you're not on any anticoagulants. Actually, we often send these people home to sit and wait it out. But the sort of older, frailer people with big bleeds, we keep them watch and reassure.
Makes sense. And how do we know if someone's got diverticulitis? So obviously this is moving into that next stage of what we're going to talk about. What would make you think that this could be diverticulitis rather than symptomatic diverticulosis?
So the two things that sort of make a big difference to me are fever and systemic malaise and pain that's not settling. And when you examine them, percussion tenderness is my go-to for peritonitis. So if they've got percussion tenderness either in the left lower quadrant or generalized, I'd be more worried about them. Interestingly, the ACP, that's the Coloproctology Society, say the absence of vomiting fits in with a presentation of diverticulitis rather than something else that might cause abdominal pain.
And is it common for them to have bleeding with diverticulitis?
You tend to get one or the other. You tend to either get a bleed or you get the inflammation and the sort of associated infective symptoms, but they don't usually come together.
Okay.
Not sure why.
And in primary care, we see a lot of patients who've got known diverticulosis. They come to us and in the past, perhaps they've been treated with antibiotics for their diverticulitis, and they think that that's what's going to help here. I just want to go through that scenario a bit more and just break it down. So if a patient did present to you known diverticulosis in primary care, you examine them, you're thinking that there could be diverticulitis present. Are there any tests that we can do in primary care that can help? Would you recommend things like blood tests or anything else?
If they're systemically unwell, they've got a temperature, you're worried about them, send them up to us and we will do all of that. We always happily see them, and an ambulatory surgical unit is the right place to see these patients. Mm-hmm. If you think actually this is this sort of symptomatic diverticulosis, it's pain. Sometimes they get a bit constipated, makes them uncomfortable, but actually they're well in themselves. I would always send bloods. It's quite common for us to see people who tell me that they've had 4 courses of antibiotics in the last year, but no associated blood tests that show that inflammatory response. And then I would give them simple analgesia, so paracetamol, buscopan can be quite helpful. Usually a cut down the diet, make it pretty bland, low fibre when they've got that flare, and then wait for the blood tests to come back. Because often the bloods won't show any significant raise in the inflammatory markers, and by the time you've caught up with them, the flare has passed and they're feeling better. And then that's the end of that. And then it's about, as you say, the patient's expecting antibiotics because that's what they always get for their diverticulitis. And actually it's managing their expectations and their understanding, saying that this is really strongly evidence-based, that for these patients, you don't need antibiotics, that it doesn't make their disease progression worse or longer. It's supported by NICE guidelines. It's supported by the Association of Coloproctologists. They're all saying antibiotics make no difference in uncomplicated pain, but nothing else. And then it's watching out for those that are actually more unwell with it. I'm always a bit more cautious in the morbidly obese. They tend not to present quite so classically with the peritonitis. It does tend to mask better. And then again, bloods are really useful. So a CRP of over 150 is definitely more likely to be a complicated diverticulitis. And over 200, they say it's more likely, it is quite a strong indicator that there's a perforation. So it gives you something sort of really specific to work with.
That's helpful, yeah. So something quite objective to hang your hat on. So just talking about that, you mentioned about you'd like to see certain patients. Can you give us some advice on who you think we can manage in primary care and who you feel should be coming up to secondary care for their management?
So in the acute situation, people with pain but no systemic malaise or temperature, I would follow the simple management and send some bloods. And then if the bloods come back raised, you can give them a course of antibiotics if they're not getting better by that stage. People I would want to see, anyone with percussion tenderness when you examine them, anyone who's spiking a temperature or that you've done bloods and there's a good CRP rise. I mean, good CRP rise is a bit subjective, but somewhere 50 to 100, that sort of thing I'd be interested in, because usually we scan them. And the scan will then tell us whether this is uncomplicated or complicated diverticulitis, and that helps us manage them from there. And then in the more elective setting, the people I'd want to see are someone that you've noticed has had 2, 3, 4 presentations with complicated diverticulitis needing hospital admission, or they've had a good going inflammatory rise and you've treated them with antibiotics. People who've got sort of intermittent obstructive symptoms that scan might show they've got a stricture. Anyone with signs of a fistula, because obviously that's quite distressing. These are the people that we would consider for surgery or an elective sigmoid colectomy to try and prevent their ongoing problems. But people with just pain, they don't get better with a colectomy.
And you talked there about complicated versus uncomplicated diverticulitis. Could you expand on that? What do you mean by complicated and uncomplicated?
So uncomplicated diverticulitis is just the presence of inflammation on the scan. We'll see some inflammatory stranding, but no free air, no evidence of perforation. Complicated is perforation or fistula formation or stricture formation, but in the acute setting it's usually perforation related. And then we look at it a bit more closely. So if you've got a localized perforation, you've got an abscess that's less than 4 centimeters, you're systemically well, we would probably just manage those with antibiotics. And we tend to monitor people 48 hours on IV antibiotics. Their pain's improving. We can switch them to orals and send them home. Some of them were actually using the NHS at home IV antibiotics service, but they would be getting better. And then the more complicated ones of the complicated are the ones who've got free air, and the majority of those end up needing surgery. An abscess bigger than 4 centimetres, and we usually do a radiological drain for them. Those are the ones that require more intervention and definitely need hospital.
If in primary care we're giving antibiotics, the scenario that you were talking about there was patient with some systemic features but no rebound tenderness and the CRP mildly elevated, you're thinking it could be a diverticulitis, you do give antibiotics in the community. Which antibiotic would you give, and how long after starting it would you review them?
So it's a it'll be a local guidelines. I think amoxiclav is very commonly prescribed, and the NICE guidelines say something broad spectrum. I would want to see them improving within 2 to 3 days to know that that was working, that we got the diagnosis right. And I'd probably do that once, maybe twice in the community. If you're ending up giving a third course of antibiotics, then they should probably have had a CT to see exactly what's going on, make sure we haven't missed something else. And anyone, just you've got that gut feeling that this is not right, because obviously occasionally you get a cancer that presents in a diverticular segment and we don't want to miss those.
So you need to keep your clinical judgment sharp.
Absolutely.
And
which is hard, because I'm sure you see 100 of these a week, and it's picking out those ones that just don't feel right, or that you're worried about, or they've got risk factors. Mm. So immunosuppressed, or as I said, the morbidly obese, they just don't quite present the same.
It is a common presentation in primary care. We see a lot of patients who are known to have diverticulosis, and it can be difficult because abdominal pain is such a common presenting feature for so many patients in primary care, and trying to find out who needs treatment, who doesn't, is really difficult. And I think that we do probably overprescribe antibiotics in this situation, so having some advice and guidance around that is really helpful, so thanks. So
I think we do too, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And there are probably, I guess, the ones that make it to hospital, we think, oh well, it was bad enough you got to hospital, we'll probably still give you antibiotics. So I think we're guilty of it too.
Yeah, it's very difficult. So just to run through that, so with the diverticulitis, we're looking for features of systemic inflammation that might guide us towards that. Blood tests are going to be helpful, so potentially getting some blood tests to look for that CRP or that inflammatory rise sounds like that's a good thing to do. Antibiotics for those ones would be appropriate, but also thinking about complications and complicated diverticulitis like you were mentioning, and then also having that slightly more nuanced approach to the obese patient, those on immunosuppressants, those sorts of things where presentation can be a bit trickier. Does that sound?
Sounds, absolutely. Right. And as I said, all of us just need to stop and think before we give them antibiotics. And I think that's just a lot of education of patient expectations. It's a really easy thing to do, but we all know that it's we overprescribe.
So we're coming to the end, Mel. Do you have any top tips or key messages that you'd like to give to our GP audience? This is your opportunity to do that.
I think you've probably summarised it there. It's about managing patient expectations when they come in with the left lower quadrant pain, this sort of concept of symptomatic diverticulosis that really doesn't need antibiotics. They just have this stiff-walled colon. I think this is bread and butter for GPs. It's about managing your baseline health, your smoking cessation, obesity, etc. I suppose if you've seen someone post-operatively who's had a Hartmann's and an emergency admission, again, reinforcing that self-care, that healthy lifestyle will make any potential reversal operation more likely. I would definitely want a patient to lose weight before I reverse their stoma after an emergency Hartmann's. I also think the other thing from a hospital point of view, so I suppose this is less for your GP practice, but reasonable for you to query it. At the moment, we still arrange a flexible sigmoidoscopy or colonoscopy after a presentation with acute diverticulitis, and we do that for everyone. But actually, the guidelines say if it's uncomplicated diverticulitis on a CT scan, we don't need to. and it's only the complicated ones, and again only if they haven't had a scope in the last 2 years. So if you or your patient are sort of querying, oh, do I really need this scope, that might be worth flagging to the person who requested it.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Mel. That's really helpful. A really nice summary and a really helpful episode, just looking at what is actually a really common presentation and trying to demystify that a little bit and work out where we go. So thank you so much for giving your time.
You're very welcome.
Brilliant. Thank you. There was so much practical advice in that episode. So much useful information given to us there by Mel about how to really approach those patients with suspected diverticulitis. It's quite hard for me to pull out three simple learning points here, but I'm going to have a go at it anyway. So one of the things I took away was that it's actually increasingly common in younger people. So Mel mentioned that about 5% of 40-year-olds could have diverticular disease or diverticulosis. So we really need to think about it as a cause for left iliac fossa pain in 40-year-olds as well. So really bringing that age bar down and not considering this just a condition of older adults, but also those who are in their 40s. Secondly, it was thinking about medications. It was interesting, Mel was saying that non-steroidals can increase the risk not just of diverticulosis and diverticulitis, but also can increase the risk of perforation in those who have diverticulitis. So important for us to consider various medications there. And then the final thing I took home was the assessment of the patient with possible diverticulitis and trying to identify those who need a more urgent assessment. And Mel was talking about how important that percussion tenderness and obviously those observations of the patient are in identifying those who might need a more urgent assessment at the hospital. So all in all, a really interesting episode, lots of really helpful practical advice. I feel more confident about taking this into my practice and understanding how to approach these patients. And I hope that you have taken some useful learning points home with you as well. So thank you so much for joining us, and do tune in for our next episode. And if you've enjoyed these episodes and you're enjoying Ingest, please do follow us so that you can receive an update whenever we produce a new episode, which we aim to do every month. Thank you very much.